Hello and welcome to the N17 podcast. My name's Cosmo. Tonight, I'm joined by Eddie.
Good evening.
And we've got our ray of optimism, a ray of hope. Forever the optimist on this pod, Aaron Kay.
Good afternoon.
Very similar to Ryan Mason in that sense, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. The optimism is needed, but I'll be honest, the last couple of games it's been wavering. But then the team sheet comes out, the build-up starts to happen, and you get sucked back in. So, well,
that's the thing. That's what I wanted to start with, because we were, especially on the last pod, I think we were so apathetic. And we've been apathetic for a long time, let's be honest, under the waning results under Conte and just the play in general. And Stellini was basically more the same, let's be real. But I think especially with that fight back against Liverpool, at least before the crushing disappointment, and when you tie in the performance against Manchester United, I'm invested again. Like, I haven't been this whole season. I've been pretty checked out. But there's something about Mason. There's something about, I don't know if it's the way we're playing, but I just feel a bit more connected with the club right now. I think it helps to have a manager that actually gives a shit. We saw that in the post-match interviews. You know, it's nice to have a manager who doesn't just slag Spurs off after every bad result. Eddie, I'll be curious to know where you're at with that. Have you felt some investment come back?
I guess compared to Conte and Stellini, where I could not care like what happened based on the result. I cared about the result. I support Tottenham, but I wasn't wishing them well. It's kind of a weird thing to say, but like just the fact that they've been part of a downward spiral in the club and didn't seem to care about like the state of the club just made me so apathetic to what was going on. To the fact that it got tied into the results, I couldn't care less if we were winning or losing. It was just another week. I think Mason has changed that a lot. Just because you kind of get the sense that like, I mean, he's Spurs through and through, right? And so that goes a long way to like making you feel like the change at the club or the atmosphere at the club is going in a positive direction, because you get the idea that it isn't just a job for him. And I think that's the key difference, like between even Mourinho, Conte, and obviously Stellini, like it's a job for them, and it felt much more like the mercenary aspect of football. Whereas with Mason, this is the second time he's been a caretaker manager. You get the sense that he like cares about the club, and like that's his primary focus, just like getting the club into like a good position, whether that means that he'll get the job or not. I think that's the important thing.
I don't know. I don't know about you guys, but I'm starting to warm to that idea a little bit. Again, it's something I've said in the past. I don't know if I'm so beaten down by the mediocre results and the way of playing and having managers that almost just like gaslight us on a weekly basis. But just having a manager that actually feels Spurs feels good to me. And in a weird way, we will get into the crushing disappointment, but there was something about that result which just reminded me, it was just very Spurs, obviously in an awful way, but it was so Spursy. It was almost like the epitome of being a Spurs fan. But I don't think even though it was a negative emotion, I don't think we've had anything comparable to that in recent years in terms of, I'm not saying the DNA should be about throwing away games or whatever, but at least we showed that fight, and that's been missing for years. At least we showed the gumption to be like, okay, we're 3-0 down, we've got it back to 3-3. We're going to try and win this game 4-3. I think, and that was refreshing to see. Aaron, where are you at in terms of Money Mace?
I think the first thing that comes to my mind is that he is living the Spurs fan dream. Everyone who's grown up wanting to support Tottenham or having to support Tottenham has then gone on to think about what it would be like to be in his seat and manage the club that you love. And he is in that position that he deeply cares for the club. And I think that given his, obviously he was forced to retire very, very young. I'm going to come back to that in a minute and some of Jurgen Klopp's comments as well, but I'll circle back to that later on. He's been forced to retire young. He's not too much older than many of the players, and he played with quite a few of them. And I think that because he's got a good relationship with them on whatever level it is, even if it's a peer-based relationship, he's able to, he has a voice in the dressing room that they will listen to. And I think that based upon the dark days that Mourinho and Conte sort of instilled, and as you mentioned earlier on, just berating everyone left, right and centre, Mason, I think himself is more of a radiator than those drains that I previously mentioned. And his ethos and his love of the club will translate onto the pitch as well. And I think that it does. And I think that although he may not have the experience of those other managers, his positivity, and I kind of liken it to a bit of the Ollie at United, that it was vibes. And that's the thing, what we need. I think we need a little bit of vibes at the moment, just people playing a bit freer and the people playing to their strengths. And we can talk tactically about how all year Son has been played, let's be honest, out of position and 40 yards further back from where he needed to be, where we've seen in the game against Liverpool, when he was actually able to run at defenders or run in behind, he was so much more effective. He had Konate on skates for about an hour. And I think that any Tottenham fan could have seen that Son was not having his greatest year. And that is because he got moved drastically. And if you look at his best form for Spurs, it's in a position where he's been able to do that, running behind. And I don't think it takes an untrained eye to point that out. But my vibes for Mace is that I would prefer for a new manager to come in. So a Nagelsmann would be my ideal choice, and Mace still to be around just to give it a Tottenham feel. But obviously, Nagelsmann's had his speed bumps with his... Well, it seems to have speed bumps of his negotiations. But for me, Mace is the man to the end of the year. I don't really want to see it longer than that, to be honest.
I think that's fair. I mean, he's very unproven. I just wanted to posit the question. Do you think managers such as Nagelsmann might be wary of Mason in the fact that he does seem to have become a bit of a clutch for the club in terms of he is someone that we go back to every single time a manager doesn't work out? Do you think a manager with a big ego might be like, well, I don't want someone like that around? What do you think, Eddie?
I don't think so. I don't think he'll end up like that because Mason is someone who's gone through the transition of these different managers that has remained at the club and would actually be a good, like, how do I say it? He's like a walking guidebook for the club. Like, you get the sell from Daniel Levy, and you'll get the buy-in from the players. But how do you get, like, the full picture? And I think Mason would be, like, someone that's really important to that. However, what I do think is that how much is Mason contributing on a day-to-day basis when he's not, like, in this role that he currently is in now as a caretaker manager? I doubt it's that much, considering the difference in style between Mourinho and Conte and the fact that he's been there for all of it. And so I don't know how much he's like actually contributing to Tottenham's style of play. And therefore, in that sense, I do think that he deserves the opportunity to put his stamp on the team, but just not at Tottenham. Not yet anyways, because, yeah, like we've already said, very inexperienced, very young. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's an important time for Tottenham. And in my opinion, Mason would prove to be another big kind of swing and a big kind of... You're trusting in him to take over at a crucial time for Spurs. And from an emotional standpoint, I don't want that to hurt his career because I don't think he deserves that. And the pressure to get it right... because you know, the fans are going to be on him. They'll support him, of course, but like now when he gets a job full time, they're not like, we've seen how fickle our fan base can get. They've become fickle with some of our best players of all time. So like it's a very difficult role. And I think, yeah, I think someone like Nagelsmann, who's, I've never said this guy's name as much as I have in the last like 3 weeks. But someone like him, he's managed that big clubs that are going through a transition like RB Leipzig. I think that's going to be the smarter choice. But, you know, with Levy, you've got to think, you know, the economic choice, you've got to think what the fans want, you know. So it might be a more attractive option to leave than it is to me, for instance.
Yeah.
Do you think Mason would be the more attractive offer for Levy than Nagelsmann would be?
Well, just in terms of like, you've already got him. You don't have to go through the negotiations. You don't have to sell the club to Mason.
Cheaper.
You don't have to compensate Bayern Munich. You don't have to put in a massive new contract for him. Yeah. So there is that aspect. Yeah. And also, if we were to be cynical about it, Daniel Levy's not going to give as much money to Mason. There's just no way he's going to back Mason as much as he would back another manager, in my opinion. So there is that aspect. And I don't know what Mason's style is. I can't tell you what he enjoys, what kind of players that you would say that would fit his system, because he hasn't managed to do that at a club yet. And so that's why I think you do need someone with an established style of football, because what we're seeing is just Conte with the handbrake off at the moment. And, we need a style of football.
Yeah. I want to use that to talk about like the first 15 minutes, because I think while the vibes are good, you have to ask questions about like what the hell is going on in terms of like, Eddie, me and you watched the match today highlights back before this, before the pod, just to refresh our memories. And some of the defending was just unbelievable. Like, I don't understand what's going on. And this is something that I almost feel like, not almost feel, I feel like this is a hangover from Conte. Somehow Spurs have about 8 players behind the ball, and yet there's huge gaps everywhere. Can you explain the kind of why this keeps happening, the tactical aspect? Like, is it just because the players are bad? Is it because of the way they've been trained? Is it the way they're set up? Because it kind of dumbfounds me at this point.
I've got an idea, but this is mainly to do with the defenders, but it could also be to the rest of the team. I think the biggest fault I'm finding with the way we've conceded goals is just like the complete lack of communication. And it's clearly evident in the two of the first 3 goals, aside from the penalty, which is like just a ridiculous decision from Romero.
Oh, what was he thinking?
But that was after a ridiculous decision by Dier.
Yeah.
So both of them contributing to just a horrendous, you know, calamitous bit of defending.
I just to jump in on that for a sec, I don't think I've ever seen a defender tackle like that in the box. Like, I've never seen that in football, ever.
He flew in.
Both feet.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't describe it to you.
And then he said he got the ball.
What are you going to do? You're going to say that you didn't?
Just beat the ref. Yeah, fair enough, mate. Fair enough. I've done that at Sunday League. You just clean someone out. You're like, well...
You have shame. Romero didn't have shame. But I think the first 2 goals is a clear indication of poor communication, because...
Or lack of quality?
I think it's poor. I think it's a mixture of both, but I've seen a lot of poor communication because for some reason, as a football club, our players are completely unable to pass on other players to another person in our team. the clear evidence of this is Curtis Jones, who's playing at left centre midfield, and he was playing in that pocket for the whole game. And for some reason, a central midfielder where we have five defenders is finding space in the box because our right centre-back and our right wing-back are both marking their left winger, who, by the way, is what, 5'9"? So this is part of the reason why I'm finding it increasingly frustrating, because across that back line, especially in the back three, it's so much easier to pass on players compared to a back four or, you know, two centre backs. If, for instance, that's a back three. Of course, a back five, if the right wing back is marking the full back, then the right centre back marks the right winger. If the full back's not even in the picture, then the right wing back can get the left centre midfielder and the right centre back can get the winger. It's so simple. And if there is an overload, or even you're not sure where the attacker is, pass on that attacker. Look the next person to mark. Porro, who's done this in previous games, completely neglects that part of his role. And listen, Manan could tap that in in the box.
I didn't want to be too harsh on Forster, but in slow motion, it does look like your nan could have tapped that in and even got that.
It's a great cross. It's on a plate for him. So that's the first aspect. And then that's it within 3 minutes. Just, you can't even say that's tiredness or laziness. That's just your brain not being switched on. And then 2 minutes later, the exact same thing happens again, where you're not passing your man on. You're not aware of where the attacker is. And how is it that Luis Diaz, again playing on the left wing, is in the center forward position, and neither one of Dyer, who should have stopped the cross coming in the first place, or Romero are getting ahead of Luis Diaz, who's coming from out to in, and Porro's not getting in the way of that run. You block that run, you make it difficult for him. It was such a difficult finish, and he managed to get ahead of both those defenders and score. And to me, it's just a clear indication that no one's communicating across that back line. And if you're going to continue to do that, if you're going to continue to not pass players on, not communicate with each other, then you're just going to get some utterly, utterly calamitous defending, as we've seen in the last three games where we've conceded 12 goals, 11 goals.
11. Yeah, 11 and 3, shocking. Do you know the sad thing about this is the fact that I think finally, even though Porro, I mean, we could have a conversation about him. I'm not sure time wise whether we should delve into that just yet. But the sad thing is that I think the wing backs finally actually look like wing backs at the moment. I thought Perisic had a cracking game going forward. Porro as well, he was dangerous, and it just speaks to the fact where, if we had better centre-backs, I feel like this formation would be a lot more viable. Not that Antonio Conte was using his wing-backs in a way that would kind of, like, for that to even make sense, because he just had them in a back five. But I don't know, maybe Conte was doing that because he just knew the centre-backs were too poor.
On Mace Ball, if you look up, a lot of all the goals, in my opinion, that we conceded were down to individual errors. Nothing to do with how Mason set them out, in my opinion. And on another day, we're talking about a game where Jota is the winning goal scorer is sent off for a red card, and we're given a penalty for whatever MMA moves Konate is doing on Richarlison. Like, on another day, we win that game without question. And I think that Mason deserves a lot of credit. And I think he did speak very well in his post-match interview in comparison with Klopp, who was not a expletive you want to use.
Let me not get onto Klopp, because
don't get Eddie started on Klopp. You know Eddie will send for Klopp when we have the Liverpool fixture like 10 games away.
I will say something about Klopp later.
The only thing that I want to say is that the way he was asked if he thought that it was a red card, and it was the whoever was interviewing suggested that Mason felt that it was, and Klopp was like, "Oh, they need to play better football." Like, what are you talking about?
Okay, right. Klopp's triggered me there because we played the better football throughout that game. We were by far the better team in that game. Like, watching the highlights back, we destroyed them. We made so many chances. We were so unlucky not to just completely, like, batter them if we took all our chances. Like, Son hitting the post, Romero hitting the post. Like you say, the penalty, Stonewall penalty. They should have had a man sent off. Although I do think Skip was a lucky boy not to get sent off as well, to be honest.
That's true.
Which is very unlike me to kind of like fall on the other side of a 50-50 against Spurs. But I do think that was a factor. But yeah, let's talk a bit about the fight back, because I think so attacking, we played brilliant in that game. I think like Porro, Perisic, fantastic. Kane, oh my God. Like, I really take him for granted. I think I'm more guilty than most for taking him for granted. But like, watching the highlights back just before now, like there was one where he played a ball out to Porro on like the half volley. He didn't even look up to see where Porro was. He just played an inch perfect pass on the volley, just like sweeped it 40 yards. I mean, that was for a good chance. Can't remember what chance it was, but
I think it's when Porro shot, maybe.
Was it when Sam hit the post? Yeah. If I remember.
It could have been. But there was also other chances, like Kulusevski. That he should have buried that or passed it to Kane. Kane was furious with him. But that's the thing. There are green shoots here. There is kind of something to believe in. I know that the season is basically over now, but you know, there was positives in that game, I think.
I think looking forward, what do we want from this season? Do we want fifth, sixth? Or are we better off not being in Europe? No one wants to take on this like American term of like tanking games. To fall down the table, but like what do we want? We don't want to be in the Conference League, in my opinion. Do we want to be in the Europa League? Maybe.
Ideally, you wouldn't want to be in Europa League. You definitely wouldn't want to be in the Conference League.
Absolutely.
But we've seen the kind of the feeling that tanking games essentially creates. It's awful. It's unwatchable.
Yeah.
It makes you feel like you can't even be bothered to watch to turn the TV on and watch Spurs. So for me, I just want Spurs to win games. Where we end up, we end up. In an ideal world, we'd finish eighth and not be in Europe next season. But I'd rather us just win games. And you know what? The Europa League is a good competition. I wouldn't mind being in it.
Is that fifth and sixth?
Fifth and sixth, yeah.
I think with, like you said, Cosmo, the fact like no one wants to see like Tottenham throw away games, and I don't think that will be good for the team either.
I agree.
I do think that we just need to continue to play without the handbrake, because either way, do results really matter now? It kind of, but it means more for other teams, I think, at this point. I think we need to get back to creating chances and scoring goals and like putting players in the positions that they need to be. Because for the longest, we would have said that the problem with Son is that he's got no confidence and that he's playing with like a kind of like a shadow over him or cloak, or he's playing with like a blindfold on, because he's lacking confidence, when really it's all about putting the players in the right positions. You get Son on the shoulder of pretty much any centre back in the Premier League, and they are terrified, absolutely terrified. You know, they would have been playing Konate to combat Son's movement and pace, and even then, like, he was absolutely, you know, he was
terrorized.
He was on skates.
Yeah.
And to think, you know, and Konate is a very quick defender despite his size. He was absolutely terrorized all game. And I think we've said this before, you put Son in the positions where he can thrive, and he will do the business for you. And his average position this like season must have been behind the halfway line. It's been ridiculous.
It was like a defensive mid.
Yeah. It's just
certainly been not a goal scoring golden boot winner.
Perisic's average position is way higher than Son this season, which just goes to show like just where it was going wrong for us. And yeah, we just saw even in the United game, just like getting him in those positions is going to like yield results. And I guess the Liverpool game is fresh in our minds, but the United game is another indication that there is something there to work with players like Son and Kane. Like, those two are the constants in this team. And it's difficult to not view this season as a season with caveats. You have season-ending injuries for Bissouma and Bentancur. You have a season-ending injury for Emerson when it happens. You have injuries to Davies in like key points of the season. Richarlison's barely been an option this season. And you view that, and then you view the just the utter like, you know, the tumultuous nature of the management in Conte, Ben Stellini, and like take all of that and put it into this season. Like, of course we're in the position that we're in. Like, how many teams are going to be able to like navigate that and still be fighting for top four? I would probably say not too many. Not too many with the depth that we have, which is not a lot.
Well, so, I don't think even United could stomach that. And not I say even United as if they're a great team. I say United because they've spent a lot of money. Like, you know, they've got an 80 million centre defensive midfielder in Casemiro. We could never spend that money. But we've seen with them, it only took two or three injuries and they were just falling apart.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it's hard to actually be able to say, look, like, this is obviously been a step backwards for Spurs this season and we've underperformed. But like, given the circumstances, it's hard to say like how much better it could have been. You know, let's say we sat Conte a few weeks earlier or even like a month earlier or even after the World Cup. How significantly does that change our season? I don't know.
If you look, I'm not sure on the exact date of when they sacked him, but we have the exact same record as Villa, and they ditched Gerrard, and Unai Emery's done an outstanding job with them, and they're at the exact same record as us. So I'm sure if you look at the record from when he took over, I'm sure they're definitely going to be above us. So we could have sacked him earlier, maybe got more action, and maybe have grappled into top four. I'm not sure, but I think that given as you explained, the injuries that we've had and the roller coaster of a season that we have been on, I think we've just got to build ready for next year now.
Where are you guys at with Richarlison out of curiosity? Because I remember a few weeks ago, like, I stuck up for him on Twitter when people were like calling him a flop, because for me, when he comes on, like, we at least look a bit more vivacious, like we look like we have a bit more vitality about us. Obviously he hasn't, until then he hadn't scored in the Premier League, but I think he'd been so unlucky with like the amount of offside goals. I mean, a lot of the times they were ruled out for like a fingernail offside, like it was completely ridiculous. Where are you at with him going forward? Because you would still think, personally I would still think, that front three of Kulu, Kane and Son, when they're fit and firing, he probably doesn't get in that. So what do you guys make of it?
I think that he's had a better season than Kulusevski for sure. And I think if you actually watch the performances, a lot of the times, especially early in the season when we were begging for Richarlison to start, when Son was definitely in some absolutely dreadful form, I think a lot of the time early in the season and again now, I think that Richarlison has outperformed Kulusevski at least. And it's that thing we keep coming back to about how we have these players that play brilliant. We've loaned them in for however long, for 6 months, loaned the obligations to buy or whatever. And then we get them on the permanent and they just dip. But I think that I'm still in on Richarlison 100%. I think that calling him a flop as someone is just looking at stats and hasn't actually looked at the performances that he's that he's put in. And obviously, when you pay that amount of money, you're looking for your forward players to be getting in more of the goals. And he has been unlucky. But I also think that he has been, it says like 21 appearances or whatever, and one goal. It doesn't take into consideration the number of substitute appearances they have been when we've been backed against the wall, already down in the game. Lots of things that aren't taken into consideration. We just see the lack of goals because he has been playing well. So I'm still in on him.
And for me, he is still an exciting player. Like, I think that the kind of play that he brings, the angle that he brings, the type of forward that he is, it's very, very hard to come into a game cold. Like, whenever you're chasing the game, or whenever you're when your team is down and you haven't been able to get a chance to grow into the game, to get a run of fixtures down, it's like difficult. I can think of maybe two or three strikers that could do that, like could just jump into the team and score. And like players like Chicharito Hernandez, like come to mind, like as a player who would like not play at all, then come on and score. But those are very few and far between. Like, you're not going to get that level of striker who's able to just like jump into a game cold, score, and then be on the bench for the next five games and get bit part. You know, here you go, here's some minutes, type minutes. Like, it's very difficult for a striker to build up any sort of, like, rhythm or form. And to be honest, like, we don't play in a way that is conducive to the way that Richarlison plays. He doesn't play up front as a number nine for us. And he is not a creator. We've seen him create, like, just through sheer kind of, like, you just through sheer like work hard and hustle and harry and laying it off, but he's not a creator. So putting him in like those like wing positions is gonna hurt his game, because he's not a focal point. And we don't play in a way where he's gonna be chasing down balls all the time, because we play into feet, we play into Kane, and then Kane gets the ball away. And I think you can't have two of the same as well. That's why Son and Richarlison would never really work at the same time. And they probably hurt each other because they have similar intuitions when it comes to being in goal scoring position. So, yeah, I think we haven't played to his strengths. And I mean, depending on whether Kane leaves or stays this summer, we're probably yet to see the best of him. But I'm not worried. I'm seeing enough to say that he will like be an effective player if we actually play to his strengths.
Yeah, I agree. Right, we're running out of time on the Zoom, so let's go to a quick break and come back for part two. Hello, welcome back to part two. I was lowering the vibes off air just there by saying what is Poch going to walk into at Chelsea? I still can't believe that's happening. Gutting. But talking of lowered vibes, Eddie, we've got to talk about your boy, your man from Five Guys, Lucas Moura. What the hell was going on there?
If I didn't tell that story on the last pod that this happened, did that set off a butterfly effect where he makes that mistake?
Quite possibly. And it raises questions as to why the guy's in Five Guys anyway. He's a professional footballer.
Surely he's got a chef. Surely.
You can't be... Five Guys is like one of the most calorific meals you can consume. He still had the grease on his brain doing that. I mean, like, to be fair to him, he probably should never have been playing wing back in the first place. But still, what was he thinking? What is that pass inside? And then again, it's a brain rot that's infected many players down the years. I mean, I saw a compilation of Liverpool versus Spurs down the years, and that Alderweireld's own goal was absolutely ridiculous. There's so many. The one my mind always goes to is Kyle Walker's through ball.
The Kyle Walker switch of play.
No, yeah. No.
I knew that was coming.
No. What about Trippier's own goal against Chelsea?
Oh, yeah.
What a finish.
Luckily, I never saw that at the time. That was a rare Spurs game that I missed before I became apathetic. But, I mean, but I don't know. That was comparable.
Own goal this year that was comical as well. It's like, thighed it into the far corner.
Was that against Liverpool, that one?
I can't remember.
I mean, he did have a shocker against Salah in the first game as well. Like, that was another game where we were the better team, but we still contrived to lose it.
So often we are the better team against them.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of sums up a lot of what's gone wrong this season. Just laziness, like no kind of, you know, desire to keep the win or to keep the points. It was a ridiculous decision. As a footballer, there's about 10 different things he could have done in that position, apart from providing a defense split and pass for Jota. There's about 10 different things he could do. He could even get his head to it, you know. Yeah,
that big shiny head.
He can volley it.
I guess what he's thinking is we got to keep possession. We don't want to lose the ball.
It was a 95th minute. It was
in doing so, he's played a lovely through ball to Jota. Perfect weight on the pass.
Yeah, genuinely couldn't have put it anywhere worse.
It's a blind pass.
Yeah.
Like, oh, look.
Does Mason deserve some flack for putting him on?
No. Yes.
Yes.
I don't think so.
It was so late, Aaron. Why would you need to... You don't need to take Porro off. You don't need to take him off. If Lucas came on at the 78th minute, makes that mistake in the 95th minute, then I would say, you know what? That's not Mason's fault. But that decision to take Porro off is... You just didn't need to do it. You're not saving Porro by taking him off for 2 minutes.
That's true.
But we hadn't got the equaliser when he did come on, to be fair.
That is true. And I think that I've been very fickle and short-minded. Because I said after his red card against Everton, I never wanted to see him play again. And I think I'm just a little bit blinded by trying to back Mace here. I think objectively, Eddie, you are right. He probably doesn't need to come on. It's not like... Porro was absolutely gassed because he simply wasn't. And if Porro seems to be our dead ball guy now as well. I know obviously we did score from a set piece afterwards, but Porro's delivery has been good. But then again, if Porro takes the free kick, maybe we don't score. So who knows?
I don't think he would, not from that position.
No.
I do just think that's potentially where Mason doesn't have the game management that other managers might do. Like, in that position, you just keep the player on that's playing well. Like, if you, there's been times when Tottenham are playing, like, do you remember when Poch used to not make substitutions? And we used to get so frustrated. And then when Mourinho did it and he wasn't making substitutions, you're thinking, especially at that time when we had 5 subs and he was like making 2 subs in the game, you're like, why are you not changing it? And the reasoning by it that makes sense is that if the team is playing well, if the team has got the other team under the cosh, then changing it at this point may be detrimental. And that's where your experience has to come in. And say, even if I do want to change it at this point, maybe it's not a good idea to, because you're inviting a player to play in a very kind of like you have to have your head switched on type role at a key point in the game, and you have someone who's been playing there for 90 minutes. And then to bring Lucas on, who's not a wing back, who's costed us points,
and he's shit,
he was able to play. He costed us.
That's a pertinent point, to be fair.
He's costed us. What, 3 points in 12 minutes of football?
4.
Yeah. So.
No, wait, yeah, 3. Yeah, 3. Yeah.
listen, I really think that it was, first of all, a dreadful cameo from Lucas, who I said on the last podcast, even though Mason's come in, I do not want to see Lucas play. And I'm vindicated by feeling that way. And then secondly, I think it's a poor decision by Mason.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. Like, I have to agree. Like, after the Everton game, I think even before that, but especially after the Everton game, we were like, we can never see him again. Never see him again. Do you know what's funny is that I was watching it with my uncle, who's a City fan, and he couldn't understand why me and Louis, my cousin, were like so against him coming on. We were both like, as soon as we saw Lucas coming on, just making a disgusted face. Like, and he's like, I think neutrals, they just remember Ajax. They don't know what it's been like since then. One thing, though, about changing things in-game, though, Eddie, like you mentioned, like, what did you guys make the move to the 3-5-2? Because I thought it was quite interesting in the sense that it did eventually lead to a goal. But I do think for about 5-10 minutes after we moved to it, we looked really bad. Like, we just weren't keeping the ball. But eventually it paid off. So I wonder what you guys make of that.
I think it gets the best out of Kane and Son. But I think our midfield don't really know how to do it. And I think the midfield three, none of them really know who's sitting, who's going. I think they're kind of all a jack of all trades, literally all of them. None of them have sort of nailed down, I'm going to be the six, I'm sitting back holding, I'm going to be the guy who's getting into the box. They're all none of them, essentially. And I think that if we are to play a midfield three in the future, there needs to be an element of coaching into who's staying, who's going. And it comes back to that communication as well, and just a little bit of intelligence. If you see, then just looking around at your centre midfield partners and seeing what's going on. But I think that it comes from Sarr, very little football this year, really. And asking him to come in some really difficult situations is essentially what he's been born into in a Tottenham shirt. And I think that, I don't think the Skip is 100% fit yet. I still think he's getting fitter and fitter each game. And Højbjerg, who only wants to pass backwards and is only one-footed. If you see him do something with his left foot, please let me know, because I haven't seen it. And I think that those added together mean that the midfield three isn't quite going to flow in a 5-3-2.
Thing is, though, in the second half, Højbjerg, I thought, was excellent. And that's one of the things that kind of concerns me about the team more generally. Like, when we take away the vibes, when we take away the tactics, is the fact that, like, when the team felt like they had nothing to lose, a lot of the players played a lot better. And I thought Højbjerg was one of them, because he was poor in the first half. But he actually made some key passes in the second half. I think his involvement was quite key in the build-up to winning that free kick for the equaliser.
Yeah.
Does that concern you guys? Like, the fact that obviously we're very led by the game state at this point by the fact that we got back to 3-3 and then immediately lost it. But do you think that's a mentality issue?
I think that when we did make that change to the 5-3-2, we made a change, and like you say, it does get the best out of Kane and Son, but the midfield three that we have aren't the ones that are tactically kind of what's the word I'm looking for? They're not malleable. They're not the three that you would pick to be kind of interchangeable and can switch roles. Like, whereas if you had a fit midfield and you have Bissouma, Bentancur, and Skip or Højbjerg, then you can be a bit more tactically light on your feet. You can switch around. Like, either one of them are capable of doing the pressing, doing the holding, doing the arriving on the edge of the box. And yeah, I think they're going to be more kind of valuable. And what you're getting is the backups. And that's not a slight against Skip or against Sarr. They're just two very young players who are only going to mature. But it's difficult. Like, it's hard to, like, switch in-game with players that don't play together, that don't have that tactical kind of awareness to be able to switch between those roles. And it's just a formation that we haven't played this season. The one other time I remember us playing it is against Brighton, where it looked decent, but it was for a single game. And we had Bentancur and Bissouma fit. So, I just think you kind of can't really judge it based on this game. And that rocky start is going to be due to just the lack of preparedness to switch to a 5-3-2 with the players that we do have. It also meant that if any of those midfielders get injured, we are in a dire situation.
We can't play it.
Yeah, so we just can't do that in the future, really.
I know that Glenn was saying, fuck depth, we've only got, like, whatever it is, 4 games left. And to a certain extent, I do agree. But I just think if that's the system you want to play, you need to be able to play it with more than just your starting 11. You need to be able to... You just can't play it with 11 players. It's got to be a squad thing. And I think that I believe that it would also help Richarlison being up front in the 2 rather than the 3. If Son or Kane was to rotate out, but I don't see Kulusevski. I don't really see fits it at all. But again, we're looking at Kulusevski that hasn't played well really all year. I can't actually think of a performance this entire season that stands out to me as a game that he's played really, really well in. And I think that is a little bit worrying. I'm sure there is one where he's played well, but I can't think of it. But I think really looking to the rest of the year, I would like to see it. I just don't think that it is feasible, really, with the squad that we currently have.
Yeah, no, I agree, really. I agree. I suppose there is one option of dropping either Danjuma or Kulusevski in as the 10, but you know that's going to take a lot of work on the training round, so you know remains to be seen whether that can be done. One of the things I wanted to cover was the fact that the Nagelsmann links, according to Mike McGrath, have hit a stumbling block because he wants assurances over the director of football and how much power he's going to have over transfers. This is another indictment on Levy, surely. The fact that there is no clear plan to even sell to Nagelsmann, to a manager like Nagelsmann, who probably would take us to another level, is it's a huge indictment. And it shows that that the ownership kind of doing things on the fly, I think.
I think it shows that Daniel Levy is, well, rightly or wrongly, it shows that he is happy with mediocrity and he is happy with us just being on the outside looking in and not being one of the real big boys. He may try and talk the talk and say, "Coy's Daniel," here and there. But I think that if he actually wanted us to be as successful as possible, he would give these managers what they wanted. I really don't get the half backing of managers. If you want that manager to take you to the promised land, then you need to give them what they want. You have employed them because you believe they are the right person to deliver on your shared goals. If those things aren't aligned, then you can't back them. And I don't think that the lack of backing is going to get a Tottenham manager anywhere. So personally, I think we do need to bring in a Nagelsmann with whatever sporting director or assistant coaches, obviously bring assistant coaches, whatever backroom staff that he requires, so that he can then fully reassess the squad of the sporting director. Give these likes of Ndombele and Lo Celso, Reguilón, give all these people a chance if they think that they deserve them, or get them gone. I think that is what's required. And I think if we look like the front runners to secure Nagelsmann in the wake of Pochettino going to Chelsea, I just feel that it would be an opportunity to waste the chance that is currently presenting himself. Otherwise, we're going to end up with, well, not to discourage the work that he's doing, but Vincent Kompany or someone of that ilk, where quite clearly what I think Nagelsmann has the quality to become a world-class manager, I think it would be a real waste to let that opportunity slip.
Also, what he's demanding or what he's asking for is some direction on like the director of football front. It's not like he's saying, you know, like are we going to keep Kane? Are you going to invest 300, 400 million? Are you going to? It's like, I want to know that we're going in the same direction. Maybe I'm misunderstanding the intricacies of football and negotiations, but to me, that doesn't sound like something that's A, difficult to clarify, or and B, difficult to make promises on. Because, you know, regardless of whether Nagelsmann's, like, you know, tenure, if he did come to Spurs, was successful or not, like a major success, we seem to have, you know, we seem to have committed to the director of football model of football, model of footballing. So bringing in someone like Ralf Rangnick, for instance, like, it's just only going to, it's going to bode well for Spurs, regardless of whether Nagelsmann's at Spurs or not. And I think it just seems kind of strange that that would be the stumbling block. But yeah, maybe I'm just misunderstanding the intricacies of negotiation.
I mean, yeah, no, I agree. I think it's like pretty basic stuff in terms of, you know, there should be a clear direction with this, but there just doesn't seem to be. There is one thing on Twitter. We did see Daniel Levy pictured at City Airport with Paul Mann flying out to Germany, apparently. So hopefully something is moving with that, but who knows? I have to say on that, they looked so ragged, both of them. Like, they looked like they were coming back from like Amsterdam or something. Like, Daniel Levy's arse was out.
Yeah, bro. I was kind of embarrassed to see my the chairman of my club with his crack out.
Just build his bum.
As we should be.
Can I just say, I know we're gonna probably wrap up after this. Can I just say something about the Liverpool Spurs game?
I think I know what it's gonna be.
Yes. Yes, you may.
And I'm gonna have to choose my words very carefully here. The sooner that gurning fuck Klopp is out of that Liverpool team, the more I would like have an inch of respect for them. And that's it.
They've got a very hateable team.
He is pathetic. He is pathetic. The fact that he would come out and say that Ryan Mason needs to worry about the football that Tottenham are playing after Diego Jota endangers Skip's life by booting him in the head is pathetic. Especially considering the fact that Ryan Mason's career was ended by a head injury.
Mm.
And Klopp's flippant comment following that is just an indication of the type of person that he is.
He's a horrible person.
And he's a bully and he's a horrible person on the touchline. And I don't have any respect for him.
The way that he shouted at the fourth official was disgusting.
It's pathetic. And he's a looming 6 foot whatever figure, and he looms over most people, and he's a bully. And I do not like him.
Also, what the hell was that even about? Like, why was he going over to the fourth official? Because
it was when they scored, I think. And they celebrating his face.
I know, but like, what the hell did the refereeing decisions influence us getting 3 goals back? I don't think they did at all. So, if anything, they were lucky. They were lucky for the fact that Jota should have been sent off and then he scored the winner. I mean, is he taunting him over that? Is he saying, like, oh, you should have sent Jota off? I don't think so. But, yeah.
Disgusting.
Yeah, he is a prick.
He's such a weirdo.
To be fair to you, Eddie, you've always been consistent on that. You've said, you raised the alarm over Klopp before most people, so got to respect you for that.
Well, he's always just been such a weirdo, and he's always taken away so much from the game itself. Like, I've never known someone to be so adamant that, like, losses are not his fault or his team's fault. And I've never seen him conduct himself with any grace. So, yeah. I don't know. It's just, I would not dislike that Liverpool team nearly as much if he wasn't at the front of that whole thing. So there you go.
I agree. Right, I think that's a good place to end things. Thank you for joining me, boys, and as always, thank you for listening.